Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today is my good friend, Dr. Evelyn Farkas, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia during the Obama administration. She also leads the Farkas Global Strategies Consultancy and is a board member of the Project 2049 Institute to fully normalize relations between the United States and Taiwan. Last year, she unsuccessfully ran for Congress as a Democratic candidate to replace Representative Nita Lowey in New York's 17th District. In Sunday's Washington Post, Evelyn wrote a commentary, quote, "Putin is testing Biden on Ukraine. Here's what will keep him in check," end quote. Evelyn, thanks so very much for joining us. It's a pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me, Vago.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. It's an absolute pleasure. I wish I was doing this with Congresswoman Evelyn Farkas, but alas, love talking to you anyway.
Well, you know what? It's a blessing in disguise. Now I get to talk to you. I get to opine freely without worrying about the political ramifications.
you're an old friend, and I think you would have done a terrific job, and you would have made an exemplary member of Congress at a very, very important time. But still, your voice remains very important. You wrote a great piece in the Washington Post. Obviously, Vladimir Putin is amassing quite a lot of troops on the border of Ukraine. There's a lot of naval activity going on, numbers painted over on combat equipment, the same thing we saw the last time the Russians invaded, which makes this a little bit different than the saber rattling. Why is Moscow doing what it's doing now?
I think there are several reasons. Obviously, I can't get into the mind of Vladimir Putin or his little inner circle. But first of all, we have a new president in town. So, you know, President Biden, new US president, who has very clearly told Vladimir Putin, "I see you, I know who you are, I've taken your measure, and you are not going to get away with all of the things you got away with under President Trump." And of course, the reaction from Vladimir Putin is to test Biden. And this is, I would say, the first big, I mean, really major test of Biden. But it's also, I would offer, it's also part of his effort to assert his own legacy and to distract his public. So what do I mean by that? For a long time, he's bemoaned the end of the Soviet Union. He would like to reestablish a sphere of influence over that area. Ukraine is the number one thorn in his side because it would be the first piece that he would need to reassert power over. And it's related to his domestic situation because, as you know, as the world knows, he tried to assassinate his number one right. political opponent and now has him in a penal colony in jail in Russia. And that's Alexei Navalny. And so Putin's also trying to distract and show that democracy is impossible. You can't have democracy. He certainly doesn't want the people of Russia seeing success in Ukraine and getting any more funny ideas.
Is this a feint? Because I completely get the domestic argument, right? I mean, the video that Navalny produced got a lot of traction, even precipitating Putin to somehow sell. I mean, anyway, it was kind of a typically convoluted Russian oligarch kind of situation. But at the end of the day, is this any different than the saber rattling that he's done in the past?
He hasn't rattled so many sabers simultaneously since 2014. So I think that's why it's different. It is also different because, I mean, the rhetoric that's coming out of the, you mentioned, you know, the military maneuvers, but the rhetoric coming out of the Kremlin and from the voices of people like, Foreign Minister Lavrov is quite strong and accusatory vis-a-vis the Ukrainians. You know, they're mirror imaging. They're saying the Ukrainians are fixing to, you know, invade Russia. And then, of course, there's also, I think, again, the timing of it. There has been a breakdown in the stalemate / negotiations between Ukraine and Russia over the future of Donbass. But I think ultimately It is a test of the United States. It's opportunistic. It fits his needs domestically. And right. If Putin thinks he can get away with it, he will start something in Ukraine. Now, how big that something is and what his ultimate objective is, I don't even think that he knows, by the way, I should back up and say, I'm not even sure that he knows whether he's going to invade or not.
Right. So how do we prevent him from doing this, right? I mean, this situation, folks have been paying attention to it. Then it got into the broader media. And now people are discussing it, right? I mean, isn't the right way to do this at a time when there's greater collusion, I think, than we wanted to admit among Beijing, Tehran, Moscow, and Pyongyang, right? So all of them are watching how each of these situations are handled with, right? And so we're back to kind of a Cold War. You've kind of got to show everybody what you're doing, right? So there is no pullout from Afghanistan, for example, without playing into their arguments of see how they treat their friends. And I want to get to that in a minute. Don't we need to sort of deploy the 18th Airborne Corps? Doesn't NATO have, right? I mean, is there something that has to happen here that shakes the calculus up in a way that also serves as a message to other people, which I think your message was in your Washington Post piece?
Right. So here's the thing. I think that at this stage of the game, what we need to do is deter Putin from taking military action. And it is important because, number one, we have a lot at stake when it comes to Ukraine. If we let Russia take Ukraine by force to basically overthrow the democratic government there and change and make more changes of the boundaries using military force, then we're in a world of hurt because this Russian government will not stop, and they will have their eye on NATO allies. So we will be then treaty bound to respond using military force. At this point, we do not need to use military force, but we need to deter Putin. And yes, this is supremely important because of the Chinese in particular, but others watching the United States to see how we respond when international law is put into jeopardy the way the Russian government has placed it in the case of Ukraine. So it's imperative that we deter the Russians right now. How do we do that? First of all, we communicate to them very clearly that if they launch another invasion into Ukraine, that certain things will happen to them. And we should specify things like freezing Putin's assets, because we would do it ostensibly with our European allies. We should specify we would cut off any access to new sovereign debt servicing for the government of Russia and their state-owned entities. We could also, I think, I mean, we're talking about war. Why not tell them they cannot have access to the SWIFT interbank system if they invade Ukraine again? I mean, we have to be willing to take some serious economic action before we have to take military action. And I would say on the military front, we are doing some things already, not directly. I do not advocate for direct US military engagement in this. What I advocate for is strong, robust support to the Ukrainian military, to the Ukrainian government on the military front. And President Biden has already done that. He accelerated some of the assistance that probably was already in the pipeline. Right. He's deployed some, or he's reportedly deploying U.S. naval vessels to the Black Sea to maintain freedom of movement and, again, to deter the Russians. So there are things that we can do to deter Russia by bolstering Ukrainian defenses, by making it potentially more painful to the Russian military if they were to invade Ukraine.
You were in the Obama administration. Actually, you were on the desk when all the unpleasantness happened in 2014 as the Russia Eurasia person over at the Pentagon. Anybody who knows you know that you hew to a tougher line, especially when it comes to our friends in Moscow, and they know it. But one of the challenges always is, Evelyn, that we haven't wanted to go as far in sanctions. And then we don't adjust sanctions to keep the pressure on, right? I mean, sanctions work if you continuously adapt them.
Right.
Otherwise, the subject of the sanctions gets kind of used to them. We don't want to punish the Russian people, right? And at the same time, we also didn't want to impact business interests. I mean, the amount of lobbying the White House received from everybody from major aerospace companies, right? I mean, they get their titanium from Russia. They were like, ooh, let's not be crazy there, right? How do we do this and do it in a way that actually bites this time? Because I think the Russians are always kind of, I mean, just like the Chinese do, My market is big enough for you to actually not get as bothered about this as you should. There'll be some tough talk, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think this is part of the problem, that we haven't been willing to take some lumps ourselves in the West. And, you know, of course, I don't want to hurt our business interests, but at the end of the day, we're talking about democracy, which is the system of government that actually, you know, permits, that creates a permissible system for rule of law and predictability so that our Western capitalist system can continue. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that Russia and China, they're in a full frontal attack on democracy, starting first and foremost with the strongest economic, political, and military democracy in the world, which is the United States. So I think the business community, we need to bring them along and explain to them and provide them with as much insight, warning, predictability as we can. But ultimately, I mean, I met with someone in one of the big aerospace companies when I came out of the Pentagon in 2015. And I said to that person as I was leaving their office, by the way, you ought to diversify your titanium supply, you know, and I don't think they did until later, till they were forced to. Right. So, I mean, come on, guys, just like think ahead and understand that this is a geopolitical game where your political system, your way of life is at stake. And so you may have to trim your sails in certain parts of the world economically.
One of the things which I think is interesting, and I know that you and I over the years have talked about it, there is this recognition that a lot of these, I would say, aggressively authoritarian states may actually be in a deeper relationship behind the scenes, right? I mean, they all don't like the United States. They don't particularly like the West. It's sort of like, shut up and keep buying our stuff, but we don't want to hear sermonizing from you. We're not really interested in your laws. We're interested in might makes right. And you find there are actually a lot of countries that go along with it.
Right.
What is the sort of integrated strategy you need that doesn't just look at Russia, doesn't just look at China, but actually looks at both and brings a degree of consistency to that approach, Evelyn?
I mean, I think what it is it's two pronged. So there's the kind of, there's what we can do to strengthen our democracy against all of the things that these countries, you know, want to do to subvert democracy, everything from, you know, fake information and propaganda. And so that means, you know, again, strengthening our democracy, strengthening our media, some regulation of the social media companies, at least if they won't do it, then requiring some kind of editorial board, something so that content and truth, you know, so the truth has a fighting chance. and so I think there are many things domestically we can do. And transparency, of course, is a big part of that as well, because the corruption that exists to some extent in every society is what these autocratic states depend on in order to get their tentacles into democratic societies. So that also needs to be addressed by us at home. So we need to build our resilience, right, and strengthen our democracy. But the other thing that we need to do is obviously reassert that international law and international institutions that we established, the United States with our allies, with the entire, you know, Security Council, UN Security Council, were established to ensure that we wouldn't have global wars breaking out again. And this is the point I make in my Washington Post piece that came out a couple days ago, which said that in essence, if we get distracted by global wars, we won't be able to handle the planetary issues that we're dealing with, which is the COVID, you know, the pandemic or any pandemic, and the climate crisis. So, I mean, we have the climate crisis is like, just, we're lucky so far. Let's just put it that way. So, you know, we have a responsibility to ourselves, to successive generations, you know, to do something now to minimize the likelihood of global wars or major wars. And that's exactly what the international system and international law does. Does it eliminate all conflict? No. Is it perfect? Is it perfectly fair? No. But it's worked more or less since the Second World War.
Let me ask you about bringing the Europeans along with this. The pivot to Asia was, rubbed some of our European allies wrong. I think they misread it. It wasn't that you're any less important to us, but hey, we're engaged in the Middle East. We got to focus on Asia increasingly. Why don't you guys step up your own game? But for some, it was a perception that, you don't like us as much. Then we had the Donald Trump administration, which was at least at a presidential level, hostile to our European allies. And the message Europeans took from this is that if you can jilt me once, you can jilt me twice. It's really nice, Joe Biden. We think you're interested in us, but we must also strike our own path. And you're hearing Armin Laschet, who's likely to replace Angela Merkel as Germany's chancellor after Merkel steps down from her historic tenure, as saying, hey, look, we have to chart our own course. At the end of the day, how does the United States have to do this so that we bring our European allies along with us? Because they rushed into a trade deal with Beijing in part because they were getting pressure on industrial products and they wanted that market. And then the EU embraced our sanctions over Xinjiang and that deal kind of fell apart, right? I mean, so how do we get our allies and partners in on this, who are very willing and happy to do Nord Stream 2, who are happy to depend on Russia and may not want to rock any boats as a consequence?
Right. I mean, look, it's going to take hard diplomatic work. The good news is that people know President Biden. They know that he means it when he says it. I mean, he really has strong relationships with our allies, and not just in Europe, but in Asia. And I think it's important for us to pull together the family of democracies or whatever you want to call us, or even ones that aren't democratic necessarily or in the same way that we are, but understand that the international system is one where we need to abide by the rules and work together to push back against these countries and not violate human rights of their citizens and, prosecute genocide. So I would say that the Europeans can be won over. It will just take some time. And ultimately, I think that what went wrong, with the pivot to Asia was communication, that we didn't communicate to the European allies that what we meant was together we pivot. But because of course, at the same time, we have allies in Asia. So we're also pivoting with them to just take a different look at the geopolitics of the world and to address our interests differently. But we always want to go with our closest treaty allies.
Let me ask you one last question, and it's about Afghanistan. After 9/11, America's closest allies joined the United States. Article 5 was invoked for the first time in NATO history, not for the United States to come to Europe's aid, but for Europe to come to America's aid. And at the end of the day, nations have made an enormous sacrifice over the last 20 years in Afghanistan. Now, the last administration, President Trump announced a withdrawal and all hell broke loose. Now, President Biden is saying that he wants to withdraw all 4,500 American troops from Afghanistan on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 this September. What message does that send? Because the administration talks about allies and partners, but at the same time is leaving in a lurch, right? A government that is unlikely to succeed without the United States engaged in some way to protect it. And indeed, many Afghans feel like they've been thrown under the bus because the United States wants out and is agreeing to all sorts of Pollyanna things with the Taliban, which then play into Russia and China telling the rest of the world, see how they treat their friends? Hey, I'm purely transactional, but look how well I treated Assad. The whole world was against him, and I came in and I made things happen for him. At the end of the day, what message does this send around the world? We may be tired of that conflict, but the conflict may not be tired, right? I mean,
yes. You know what I mean. So, yeah, no, I think, look, first of all, we don't know exactly what's being negotiated or what the resolution in Afghanistan will be or what the terms of a US NATO, withdrawal will be, right? And we don't know exactly when that will happen. I mean, no decision has been made yet. So right now, what we hear is a lot of gnashing of teeth over what's likely to happen. I do think we have to be careful because we have certain commitments to the Afghan people. And so while we draw down or withdraw from Afghanistan, we can't militarily, we cannot abandon them. And so I think we need to think very clearly about what that looks like and whether that's some kind of security mechanism that's not a bilateral US one, I don't know. I'm not involved in those conversations. I would argue that there's a lot of creativity required. One, obviously, to deal with the domestic situation, the political situation in Afghanistan in a way that doesn't lead to a disaster for women and, you know, Afghan society. But I also think that we want to make sure that we don't shirk our responsibility. I don't have a better way of really phrasing right. it.
Is there one last follow-up to that would be, you know, I've spoken to a lot of our allies and partners who are still in Afghanistan, and their sense was, you know, we kind of all came in together and we should all sort of agree on pulling out together. Does this leave them potentially in a lurch, especially since NATO just extended the mission, if I recall, in Afghanistan?
I do think that whatever we end up doing in Afghanistan, and again, this comes back to, you know, doing things with our allies, making sure that we build trust and we address security challenges together. And when I say our allies, I don't mean just NATO allies. I mean also Japan, Australia, South Korea, you know, other countries that are with an engagement in Afghanistan, for example. So I would argue that's why I'm saying we should be creative about what's the security mechanism, what kind of deterrence are we going to provide to keep the Taliban from completely taking over and turning the clock backward, right? I mean, that's ultimately what we want to avoid. And how do we do that? What is the lever that we put in place to try to stay their hand, right? In some ways, politically and otherwise. And that, I think, is something that the international community should agree on, as many countries as possible, including even if we can get China and Russia to agree. And maybe there's a security component there that, like I said, it's not then a unilateral or a US only kind of deterrence guarantee of some sort. I mean, I'm really kind of almost brainstorming here because I right. haven't been engaged in any conversations on this with anyone in government.
I appreciate that, Evelyn, but I do regard you as one of the sharper minds in Washington on all of this stuff. And I appreciate it, right? I mean, this news has just broken roughly in the time that we're recording this. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us. I know your time is in great demand. Really appreciate it and would love to have you back on a regular basis on the program. Always enjoyed it as you part of our roundtable, and hopefully we can get your voice on the program increasingly over time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vago. It's been my pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.